May it please the court, counsel. Alan Epstein representing Office Plaza South and Donald Buick. The first matter I'd like to address is the recent filing by Lenel of supplemental authorities holding that new matters may not be raised for the first time in a reply brief. Lenel contends OPS raised a new issue in its reply brief by challenging the findings and conclusions of the trial court. But OPS was responding to factual statements made by Lenel in its answer brief. OPS was arguing that certain factual statements did not have record support. In that context, OPS noted that some of the factual statements relied on by Lynn referred to the findings and conclusions rather than record evidence. And the findings were drafted in large part by Lenel's counsel, which gives rise to a standard of closer scrutiny this court employs under Coors v. Security Life. OPS had the right to respond to Lenel's factual statements and to explain why, but by doing so, it did not raise a new issue in its reply brief. The issue, rather, is whether the trial court erred for a variety of reasons in holding OPS liable for breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The duty of good faith and fair dealing is only present in fulfilling the terms of a valid contract. Because a condition precedent to contract formation did not occur in this case, no contract was formed. Since no contract was formed, of logical necessity, the duty of good faith and fair dealing could not have arisen or have been breached.
Mr. Epstein, on that point, I seem to recall some law that says that when the fulfillment of a condition is prevented by one of the parties to the contract, that that party may not rely upon the existence of the condition to say that there is no duty.
I believe that those cases arise in the context of a condition precedent, but not to condition, but not a condition precedent to contract formation.
And do you have any legal authority that that principle, which seems to me to be kind of an equitable estoppel principle, wouldn't apply to a condition precedent to formation?
I don't have any case law that says that, and I'm not aware of any that does. This is a unique case. I've not seen one like it. I believe one of the cases cited in our opening brief is one in which the condition precedent was caused by or within the power of control of one of the parties, and still it was a condition precedent to contract formation. As we argued in our reply brief, if the contract has not been formed because of the non-occurrence of a condition precedent, and if the non-occurrence is caused by one of the parties not going through with the contract, what that really is tantamount to is interference with the formation of one's own contract. So there is not yet a contract. If there is not yet a contract, there are no duties that arise. And the necessary corollary to the trial court's ruling is that the OPS was being held liable for interference with the formation of its own contract, which is not actionable. The court ruled that Mr. Buick asking Xerox not to consent to the assignment breached the covenant of good faith and fair dealing of an extant contract, but if OPS did induce Xerox to withhold consent, what it really did was interfere with contract formation, its own contract.
Mr. Epstein, why is the condition at issue here one to formation? Couldn't the contract, the assignment, be enforceable as between the assignor and the assignee, but simply not enforceable as to Xerox?
No, it could not be.
Why?
It's impossible because both the lease and the assignment form required Xerox's consent. The assignment couldn't be formed if Xerox withheld consent, because no rights and obligations between the parties were exchanged. Xerox didn't give consent, therefore OPS could not have acquired any of the rights and obligations of the lease, and didn't. OPS was had the obligation to make the monthly payments imposed on it, but got nothing in return. So the assignment simply couldn't occur unless Xerox consented. The assignment is the transference from an assignor to an assignee of rights and obligations. It didn't happen.
But it's not a complete transfer. It's not a novation or a substitution of parties. It is rather the taking on of an additional party of the rights and obligations. The assignor typically remains liable to the obligee under an assignment. You see what I'm saying? The parties, Lenovo, it's under the assignment, in fact it says this, remains liable to Xerox for performance. But there is another party being added, that is OPS, that is also going to be liable for performance.
But it wasn't added.
It kind of begs the question.
It's a circular argument. It wasn't added because Xerox didn't give consent. OPS never became obligated to Xerox. It became obligated under the court's ruling to Lenovo, and it never acquired anything, because the lease, the right to use and purchase the lease, or the printer under the lease remained with Lenovo.
Didn't in fact OPS use, or one of its related entities use, the printer?
It was used by Hewitt. But it didn't have, but OPS never used it. OPS never acquired any legal right to use it because the lease wasn't transferred. So it sat in an OPS office, but OPS never acquired the legal right to its use or the right to purchase it as the lease allowed the purchaser, the lessee.
Did OPS use it?
I'm sorry.
Did OPS use it?
I don't know if it did. I don't know if OPS used it or not. Hewitt used it. It was for the purpose of Hewitt's use, and OPS got involved because Hewitt didn't qualify for credit with Xerox. But OPS didn't have a use for it. It was Hewitt that had the use for it. OPS owned the building.
Donald Buick had a use for it through his print by request business. So I guess the question is more accurately stated as, did print by request use the machine?
I do not. I'm not going to commit to a definitive statement on that. I believe the answer to that is no. I don't believe that print by request used it, or that print by request existed for very long. But print by request wasn't the assignee. Print by request wasn't a party to this suit at all. So I don't think it's relevant whether if in fact print by request used it. I don't think it's relevant to the issue of contract formation in this case.
There was never a claim asserted under Jet Courier against Mouliai for breach of fiduciary duty by any of the shareholders of UIT, I take it.
I don't believe that was one of the causes of action. The trial courts, I don't believe that was one of the causes. There was a promissory estoppel claim. But the only cause of action on which the trial court entered judgment was breach of the covenant of good faith.
Let me ask you about that promissory estoppel claim. As I understand the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, the trial court did not reach the promissory estoppel claim, commenting that since it was not applicable to a situation where a contract existed, it wasn't a legitimate claim for relief. Assuming that this case were to be reversed, that the court were to find that there was no contract in terms of a legitimate assignment, what happens to that promissory estoppel claim? Or phrased another way, was there a final judgment here to give us jurisdiction if the court did not reach all the claims? Because apparently he didn't deny the promissory estoppel claim.
The court ruled that it didn't need to reach it because it was entering judgment on the breach of the covenant of good faith claim. Is it a final judgment? I hadn't thought of it that way. He denied relief on the other claims and said he didn't need to reach promissory estoppel. I think it probably is a final judgment because promissory estoppel is a claim alternative to breach of contract and only is triggered if there is none. So it isn't a claim for relief that is different in terms of damages request than the breach of covenant claim. I believe the case law says that promissory estoppel is only a viable cause of action if there is no contract.
Following up Judge Graham's question, let's assume, and I'm not asking you to concede anything, that we reverse on the express contract claim and then remand for further proceedings on promissory estoppel. Would it be your position that that scenario means there's a new trial on promissory estoppel, or it just means that the judge makes further findings since the alternative promissory estoppel claim has to be addressed?
I would think that there would be a new trial on the promissory estoppel claim. It was in its answer brief, Lanell argued that this court should remand with directions to enter judgment in its favor. But as OPS pointed out in its reply brief, the elements weren't established. I think as a matter of law, the element of detrimental reliance wasn't established because, one, Leno's testimony was that Hewitt could have been asked to, had the financial resources to pay off the lease in February of 2005, but Mr. Buick's alleged remarks were made, or promises were made, in March of 2005, and there isn't any evidence, therefore, that Hewitt could have paid off the lease at the time that Mr. Buick made those statements. So there isn't any a factual basis for that reason as well. The Leno's detrimental reliance theory is that the underlying premise is that Leno had the right under the CISA agreement to require Hewitt to accelerate payments and make that whole $180,000 payment. That would have, and to their detriment, they didn't ask Hewitt to do that. But the lease doesn't require you did, or the CISA agreement did not require or allow for acceleration of the payments. It only required that Hewitt make the monthly payments that Leno owed under the lease. So as a factual matter, for that reason as well, the promissory estoppel claim failed. But at best, I think it would be remanded for a new trial on the promissory estoppel claim. I'd like to just briefly touch on Mr. Buick's personal liability. Again, the allegation against Mr. Buick is that he induced Xerox to decline consenting to the assignment. For this, he can't be liable as a matter of law. Ordinarily, a corporate officer cannot be held liable for inducing the corporation's breach of contract if the officer is acting within the scope of his official duties. Only when he is motivated solely by a desire to harm one of the contracting parties, as in the Trimble case, can a corporate officer be held personally liable. And there's no evidence that Mr. Buick was animated with animosity toward either OPS, which was his company, or toward Leno. The argument is made that he was motivated with malice toward Mr. Weiss, but Mr. Weiss wasn't a party to the contract, and the exception doesn't apply to animosity towards some third party. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's good to be with you. Looking at the events in the Middle East, I'm thankful to be in a court where the rule of law protects ordinary people. My name's Case. I'm here on behalf of Renault, Inc. I'd like to introduce you to Martin and Mary Beth Lambeth. They are the owners of Lineau. And Russ Jones, who wrote the briefs in the trial court and on appeal. To answer Judge Jones's question, there were click charges on that machine after Hewitt went out of business. And while the machine was in the possession of Print by Request. So Buick must have used the machine after he got possession of it from Renault. This appeal, who wins and who loses, can be decided by testing the truth of a single sentence in my opponent's reply brief. And that sentence is found on page 9 in the middle of the page. He said, "Here, neither party could perform at any time unless the contract, i.e. the assignment, was executed," meaning executed by Xerox. So I'd like to take a moment to test the truth of that statement, because if that's true, Mr. Buick should win the appeal on the contract issue. But if it's not true, this court should affirm Judge Knave's decision. So, was it true as a matter of fact that neither party could perform the assignment without Xerox's consent? And the answer is no. Buick was performing the obligations of the assignee from February forward. In Exhibit 21, he wrote a letter to his partners, Mr. Weiss and Mr. Bauer, telling them that he had paid on the lease to protect the credit of Renault and to make sure Xerox got their money. In Exhibit 28, Mr. Buick wrote a set of minutes attesting to his commitment to have OPS assume the lease. And in Exhibit 31, which was in his handwriting, he attached a copy of the Renault Xerox lease to those minutes in Exhibit 31 and said, OPS is going to assume this lease and pay this off, and that will release Mary Beth Lambeth and Martin Lambeth from their personal guarantees to Xerox, and it will also release Scott Weiss and Jeff Bauer from their personal guarantees to the law.
Mr. Kent, at that time that you're focusing on, there wasn't an assignment in existence. Mr. Buick and OPS were performing the obligations of UIT.
Well, that's correct. What Mr. Buick promised to do verbally in his meetings with Mr. and Mrs. Lambeth on March 2nd, 2005, and again on March 9th, 2005, and there was testimony to this by Mr. and Mrs. Lambeth that was not disputed by Mr. Buick, and the trial court made findings based on that testimony.
In what capacity? Was the promise made as Mr. Buick individually? Was it made as OPS, the limited liability company? Was it made as UIT that had the original obligation and Mr. Buick acting as an officer of UIT? Who was going to do this?
Mr. Buick promised to do it personally to Mr. and Mrs. Lambeth. And he told them on March 9th, he said, I've got the assignment form and I'm going to send it to you. And when he sent it over, the assignment form was made out so OPS would assume the obligations. But Hewitt had agreed all along that it was going to assume that. That was the understanding from the very beginning. So was it possible for Buick and OPS to perform the assignment without Xerox's consent? Of course. Xerox took money from Hewitt all the way through. They delivered the machine to Hewitt's place of business. They took payments from Hewitt. When the machine broke down, Hewitt called, and Mr. Huff and technicians went out to try to fix the broken machine. So they were dealing with Hewitt all along. All Buick and OPS did is said, we're stepping into the shoes of Hewitt. And
Mr. Case, I'm going to stop there. As I read the court's findings of fact, the only contract that the court found vis-a-vis this breach of the covenant of good faith and, good, and fair dealing was the written assignment.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
On page 12 of the findings of fact, conclusions of law and judgment, at the top, first paragraph, Judge Naves made this statement. The assignment confirmed to Lenoe and Lamberts what Mr. Buick promised them verbally on March 2nd, 2005 and March 9th, 2005.
But it doesn't. The written assignment says nothing about the guarantees. It says nothing about Lenoe no longer being liable. In fact, it says the opposite. It says that Lenoe remains obligated on the lease. So how could the written assignment confirm those alleged promises?
Well, the basic condition is the same. Buick and OPS are going to make the monthly payments on the lease as they come due.
But Lenoe is not going to be released under the written assignment. It says to the contrary twice. Lenoe remains liable.
Well, yes, well, that's what it says in the assignment.
Right.
Lenoe wouldn't have had to pay any money if Buick had just kept his promise.
But it would have been liable to pay the money. It would have remained liable. And not only that, but the assignment says nothing about the guarantors.
Well, the guarantors are not implicated unless there's a failure to pay.
But vis-a-vis Xerox, Xerox doesn't care. Xerox can go after the guarantors. It can go after Lenoe, even if this assignment is made.
Exactly.
But you're saying there were promises made that that wouldn't be the case, and the written assignment confirmed those promises. And what we're saying is the written assignment does not confirm those promises. It doesn't say the guarantors are off the hook. It doesn't say Lenoe is off the hook.
Well, I understand your distinction, Your Honor, but what we're saying is Buick promised to pay off the lease. So it wouldn't matter if Xerox said, okay, we'll do a novation and we'll let Lino out now. As long as Buick kept his word and made the payments, Lamberts wouldn't have gotten sued.
That's right, but the court denied you leave to amend to assert a breach of contract on that basis, that they had failed to make those payments. So that's off the table. I mean, you haven't appealed that. I mean, so that you're saying they breached by not making the payments. Well, that's not what the court found. Okay, the court found breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing by failing to get Xerox's consent. That's the only breach on the table here.
Well, because Buick called Xerox and said, don't sign.
All right, so let's get to the legal issue that was raised, which is whether this is a condition to formation or a condition to performance. Okay, why is this a condition to performance rather than a condition of formation, legally?
Well, legally, because as Justice Bender said, Colorado does not favor conditions precedent that allow one party to a contract to avoid formation. They don't want it. The law doesn't favor a forfeiture.
What's the forfeiture here?
The forfeiture would be Lenoe's ability to get performance out of Buick.
It just sounds circular. You're saying, well, because they did this, they didn't get the right but not the obligation to go after OPS. So therefore, we have the right to go after OPS. Sounds kind of circular.
Well, it doesn't seem that way to me. This whole case seems really direct. Buick made straight-out promises to people, gave his word, and then broke it. And that's why Renault got sued, and that's why Renault sued Buick.
Isn't what happened here, Mr. Case, is that Mr. Buick interfered with a prospective contractual right and a prospective contractual obligation? He interference with contract is what Mr. Buick did.
Well, I don't see it that way. He promised Linnell and the Lambeths that he would pay off this obligation. And then he called Xerox and said, don't complete the paperwork. I'm not going through with it. And why did he do it? He did it so he could get even with Scott Weiss. He knew that if he didn't pay it, Xerox would sue Lionel and the Lambeths. They would then have to sue Weiss. And he told the Lambeths, and the trial court found, that he wanted to drive Weiss into bankruptcy. And he succeeded. This whole thing ended with Weiss going bankrupt. So the whole scheme on Buick's part was to punish Weiss. And that's why Buick has personal liability in it, because Weiss was a contracting party.
Was he a contracting party on the written assignment?
No.
All right. So if the court's findings are limited to that, then there's no basis for liability for Mr. Buick on the written assignment.
Well, that's looking at the written assignment as if it exists in a vacuum. This document that Buick is hiding behind is part of another set of documents which were brought into play, and that is the lease with Xerox between Lionel and Xerox and the CESA agreement.
Well, Mr. Case, you say they're hiding behind it. You sued on it. You sued them on it. Aren't they entitled to rely on the terms of the agreement that you're suing them on? I mean, how can you call that hiding behind it?
It's like three boys playing baseball out in the yard, and little Donnie throws the ball over the hedge, and it sails through the neighbor's window. And out comes Mr. Jones with a red face, and he says, whose ball is this? And little Donnie says, oh, that's mine. If you give it back, I'll pay for your window. And then a week later, Mr. Jones hasn't seen little Donnie, so he goes to his house, and little Donnie says, so I can't pay you. My mommy says I can't pay. That's what this is. My mommy says I can't pay. Xerox says I'm not allowed to pay you. But all along, Buick had been making these payments.
Let me change the focus a little bit here. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Lipstein. Let's assume that we reverse on the express contract claim, which was the basis for the trial courts not reaching estoppel, and we remand. From your perspective, should remand proceedings on the estoppel claim mean a whole new trial, or should they mean only that the judge makes further findings directed to promissory estoppel, since there's no longer an express contract that by operation of law precludes the estoppel claim?
Well, as we pointed out in the brief, we think that Judge Naves made all the findings necessary to enter judgment on promissory estoppel. He found there was detrimental reliance. Mr. Epstein now disputes the record, which he didn't do in his opening brief, but the record is what it is, and the court made the findings.
Did the court make a specific finding that the interests of equity require essentially creation of an implied contract?
No, the court did not make that finding.
But wasn't that a requisite finding to prevail in promissory estoppel?
Well, yes, Your Honor, it is.
Okay, well then, if we remand, is the question before the lower court to have a whole new trial, or is the question before the lower court look at the record and make findings? What's your position?
I guess our position would be that it would require new findings from the trial court and not a new trial, because the record's already there and the testimony's already in. Problem is that Judge Naves has left that bench, and so you'd have a judge reviewing the record who's not familiar with
you know, didn't get a chance to assess the credibility of the witnesses, but the findings are there. Any more questions, Your Honors? Thanks very much.
The arguments have been completed. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel are excused, and when the tables are cleared, counsel in our next case may set up. Thank you, gentlemen.